question period, an appeal for public cash to prop up Bombardier in Quebec fuels renewed calls to pump federal aid into Alberta's oil patch. With pre-budget requests piling up, how will the government prioritize spending?
What we're focused on is how we can improve our economy in the face of real challenges. You will see in our budget efforts to make investments that are going to enhance our both short-term and long-term growth, and that will be coming in the not-too-distant future.
Free-falling oil prices and a sinking dollar. Bad omens for a federal government preparing to write its first budget. Even worse if you're penning the financial blueprint for a province addicted to oil revenue. In Alberta, federal stimulus spending can't come soon enough. For every $1 drop in the price of crude, the province takes a $170 million hit to its bottom line. In a move to ease the pain in the oil patch, the Prime Minister promised a $700 million infusion of cash for infrastructure and another $250 million from a little-used emergency fund.
Alberta and Albertans are facing challenging times, and quite frankly, Canadians help other Canadians when they're facing tough times.
The industry is banking on better access to Atlantic and Pacific ports, but a tougher route to pipeline approval with more consultations and a climate review is adding to the economic anxiety in Canada's energy heartland.
Energy East would allow Canadians to have access to Canadian resources and would create Canadian jobs. When will the Liberals get out of the way and allow Canadians to get back to work?
We understand the importance of moving our natural resources to market sustainably. That is our objective. The process that we have introduced will give us a better chance of getting there.
And with Quebec lobbying Ottawa to prop up aerospace giant Bombardier.
If the auto industry has been supported by taxpayer money, which is fine, then the aeronautical industry of Montreal needs also to be supported.
There are now calls for the Liberals to bail out big oil.
If you're thinking about another $1 billion bailout for this company that's received a lot of taxpayers' dollars already, what then about the tens of thousands of jobs lost in the energy sector out west?
We seem to be the poor third cousin sitting out in the hinterland, and we don't really feel the love here at all.
Joining me from the Alberta Legislature in Edmonton, Premier Rachel Notley. So, Premier Notley, Alberta has lost something in the neighbourhood of 100,000 jobs since the plunge in oil prices. The federal government is now talking about bailing out to about $1 billion Bombardier. What kind of bailout do you want from Ottawa? What do you need?
Well, basically what we've said to Ottawa thus far, and you know, I this is not by any means an exhaustive list, but at this point, we're looking really for three key areas of support from them in the shorter term. The first, as I've outlined before, is that we need them to look at a fast-paced adjustment to the issue of EI so that we can expand eligibility and eligibility for the length of claims. As you probably know, that in Alberta, both of those measures are shorter than any other part of the country. And obviously, we have families in Alberta that need that support now. The second thing, of course, that we're looking for is robust infrastructure funding injection here in the province as we to work together with the work that we're doing as a provincial government in terms of serving as a shock absorber and putting more money into our economy to build up the infrastructure that's been ignored for many, many years while at the same time providing more jobs. And then, of course, the third thing, which is absolutely fundamental, and this is not a handout. What this is simply good governance. It is long past the time that we as a country enhance our capacity to have a nationwide energy infrastructure so that we can get our product to the best market available to us, so that we are an integrated and progressive energy producer that does so intelligently and attracts the investment that we need to maintain internationally. So that's something that's critical for the federal government, and it's a point that I never stop making. We can be environmentally responsible, but we absolutely have to get our product to Tidewater. We cannot be vulnerable to a customer that has now become our competitor.
Well, on that last point, if Ottawa does give federal money to Bombardier to help what is a very important industry to Quebec, wouldn't it be incumbent then upon the Quebec government and Montreal mayors to reciprocate in the spirit of national unity and support the Energy East pipeline?
Well, you know, I'm not going to engage in negotiations through the media with my colleagues across the country. But what I do know is that ultimately ensuring that we have an integrated energy strategy for our non-renewable resources in the country, that will help all Canadians. It won't just help Alberta, it will help all Canadians, because all Canadians benefit when our economy is strong as a result of being able to secure the best price possible for this product. And so that's certainly the point that I make. I understand that people in Quebec and other parts of the country are somewhat concerned about the product or have some concerns about the process in the past. I believe that the federal government is moving forward to try and deal with that. And I also believe that our province's very significant moves with respect to our climate leadership strategy should help to allay many of the fears that people have about the energy industry in Alberta, and that it should allow us to move forward. And so I'm going to continue to have those conversations with my colleagues across the country and regularly with the federal government.
Well, what about Trans Mountain pipeline to Vancouver? I mean, that has some run into some opposition from the BC Premier and the mayors of Vancouver and Burnaby. And this is actually one that if you could get it, you could get the oil much quicker to market than Energy East, which would take a considerable period of time to get environmental approval, NEP approval, and to be constructed.
No, and there's no question about it. I mean, our government took a very clear position in front of the National Energy Board on that pipeline, saying that we believe that's the way forward. And so, again, it's about whether or not we have the leadership in this country to develop a pan-Canadian national energy strategy that ensures that we all benefit from us getting the best price possible for this product. The fact of the matter is you talked about the 100,000 jobs that were lost in Alberta. After Alberta, the next biggest province impacted by those job losses is BC, because so many of those folks were living in BC and commuting to Alberta for work and then going back to BC. The drop in oil prices, our inability to get the best price possible for our product, has an impact on provinces across the country. And so we need provincial leaders and national leaders who understand the need to work together to finally adopt a modernized national approach to enhancing and getting the best return for this resource for all Canadians.
Do you think Alberta is now in recession? And if not, how do you avoid it?
Well, there's no question that the economy has slowed down dramatically in Alberta. And as all Albertans understand, our government doesn't control the price of oil. It just doesn't. So what we do as a government is we've made the decision that our role is to act as a shock absorber. There are some people who are calling on us to simply look at the bottom line and to take a bad situation and double down on it, making it worse by firing the same number of people that have already lost their jobs in the private sector. Our view is that that's not the way to help Albertans through this tough time. We're going to, in fact, ensure that stability remains within the public sector, within the confines of very prudent and careful management. And we're going to ensure that those important community services, like nurses, like teachers, that what they provide, remain available to Albertans as we work together as a province to bring each other through what is a very difficult economic time.
But it is such a challenge for you because your revenue has fallen off so much because the oil prices have taken such a steep plunge. So it's difficult for you to find the money to be able to get people working again to stimulate the economy. Isn't that the biggest challenge you have?
There's no question that we have a challenge. Nonetheless, we've made a very big commitment with respect to our capital plan. We've announced that over the next 5 years, we'll be looking at a $32 billion capital investment across the province in order to catch up on much of the infrastructure that's been ignored over the many past years, and also, as I've said, to provide an alternate source of jobs to the people of Alberta. And you're right, it is difficult, but at the same time, Alberta has the lowest debt-to-GDP ratio right now of any province in the country by a long way, and the national average is well over 30% right now, and Alberta's is at about 5%. So we have room to support Albertans in the short to medium term as we get through these difficult times, and that's what we will do.
Now, the federal government is about to review the temporary foreign workers program. Do you think It's a good time to loosen the restrictions and let more foreign workers in, with so many Albertans out of work?
Well, you know, our view has always been that the temporary foreign worker program has not been helpful to Albertans or to the Alberta economy for a variety of reasons. Frankly, our view has been, you know, if you're good enough to work here, you're good enough to move here. And so what I think we need to do is have a program that is integrated overall with our immigration strategy and with an overarching national labor strategy. And there's no question that right now, with the dramatic turn in the economy, we are not in a position where there's a labor shortage in Alberta of any great degree. And so we expect that to be reflected in decisions that are made federally with respect to that program. But quite honestly, over the long haul, what we really need to do is not be relying on temporary foreign workers, but rather be finding ways for those folks to become Canadian citizens and to be part of the communities within which they live and work.
The federal government is now also looking at a $15 carbon tax. Do you support this?
Well, you know, we announced that we'll be introducing a carbon levy of $20 a ton in January 1st, moving to $30 by January 1st, 2018. And so that's what we're doing because we believe that will help us transition to a greener economy, reduce emissions, and fund much of the innovation that needs to take place to help us reduce the emissions in the oil sands. This work that the government's talking about with respect to a potential floor price, I think it's an idea worth discussing. And of course, I think it's something that needs to take into account the work that has been done in other jurisdictions, or in each jurisdiction across the country over the last many years. So with that in place, I think it shows potential, but there's certainly a good deal of discussion that needs to still take place.
Now, finally, I may ask you about this. There was a bit of a kerfuffle in the Alberta legislature when your press people banned right-wing pundit Ezra Levant's Rebel TV from news conferences. This goes against the spirit of free speech and a free press, regardless of what you think of Mr. Levant's rantings and ravings. Do you regret doing that?
You know, I think as we've said before, we've asked that the matter be looked at by a senior journalist for her to look at that in conjunction in conversations with members of the press gallery and other representatives from the press, including probably the person whom you've mentioned. At the end of the day and during that time, we've decided that there will be no limitations to who comes to our press conferences, so any purveyor of social media or participant in social media may attend, and that's how we're going to go forward with this.
Premier Notley, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, keeping Canadians safe while safeguarding Canadian values.
It's often a tough circle to square.
What tops the government's national security to-do list?
Prime Minister and his cabinet have yet to offer any acceptable reason why the air mission should not continue.
By replacing planes in the sky with boots on the ground, this government is placing Canadian Forces personnel deeper into frontline combat.
The fight against global terrorism is the fight of our generation, and we turn away from it with shame.
When will our participation end? And critically, what does success look like for this mission? What's the end game?
Under fire from the Conservatives for abandoning the air war and attacked by the New Democrats for committing more troops on the ground, the government defended its redefined role in the fight against ISIS.
Tripling our contingent of trainers in the region is going to have a measurable and meaningful impact on the one thing that will ultimately defeat ISIL, that is local troops taking the fight directly to those people who've taken and invaded their homes, their lands, and their communities.
As MPs debated the military mission in Syria and Iraq,
cybersecurity,
Canada's Public Safety Minister and his Five Eyes partners met in Washington to focus on the threat closer to home.
Issues like counter-radicalization and combating cyber threats were very much on our international agenda this week.
Joining me from Toronto, Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness Minister Ralph Goodale. So, Mr. Goodell, I know you've met your Five Eyes spying partners in Washington this week, and you met them, I also know, recently in London. So is this part of a renewed intelligence operations against ISIS and the threat that they may pose to the homeland?
Well, obviously, we are increasing our security and intelligence activity in relation to ISIL and the situation in Syria and Iraq. That was part of the announcement the Prime Minister made a week or so ago. But we're constantly working with our allies in the Five Eyes, that is the United Kingdom, the United States, New Zealand, and Australia, for the purpose of making sure that we are being effective in keeping our respective citizens safe, and that we're doing that in a way that also safeguards the vital values and rights and freedoms of Canadian citizens.
Now, Canada has promised, as you said, to increase intelligence to the U.S.-led war in Iraq and Syria. Does this mean our military satellites and the communication security establishment will be playing a greater role?
Both the establishment within the Department of Defense and CSIS within my portfolio, both of them will be engaged in appropriate, helpful activity in the region, obviously. It's the kind of activity that you cannot discuss publicly, but it's part of the mission, part of making sure that Canada is participating in a vigorous way in the whole campaign against ISIL and against the dysfunctionality of the awful government in Syria. The mission that the Prime Minister described is a broader mission that focuses on the security and intelligence aspects, focuses particularly on training, on humanitarian initiatives, on supporting other countries in the region like Jordan and Lebanon, because this is a complex problem, and you need a whole of government approach, not just a unidimensional effort. We're concentrating on all fronts. And obviously, the training mission will better equip the local forces on the ground to be able to carry the battle to ISIL, and ultimately, that's where the battle has to be fought and won. And those local forces need to be trained. Canada is among the best in the world at doing that.
We also know that the country faces a threat from radicalization. Is there an effort now underway, a much greater effort now underway, to use cyber intelligence to tackle online radicalization?
Well, we need to find the ways to counteract the very negative messages lead to radicalization, especially among vulnerable young people. Important research work has been done in Canada over the last two or three years through the Kanishka program. The RCMP and my Department of Public Safety have developed community outreach initiatives. There are some municipalities like Montreal and Calgary and some provinces like the province of Quebec that have been very proactive in developing counter-radicalization techniques, reaching out to vulnerable communities, identifying the right people in those communities and the role models that it can intervene at the right time with the right families to try to prevent tragedies before they happen. What we have committed at the federal level is to provide some heft and some coordination to this very important work, to reach out to those communities, to work on the techniques of counter-radicalization that truly work. And we learn from our own research, but we also learn from experience in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in France, and elsewhere about what the best techniques are. And we'll be creating that new Canadian National Office of counter-radicalization during the course of this calendar year.
Now, does this office work out of the RCMP, out of CSIS, or is it separate within your department?
It will be a separate entity within my department, but it will also draw upon all of the resources of the Government of Canada, and it will work with the provinces and municipalities as well. Some of the programs that have been developed by the City Police Force in Calgary and by the City of Montreal are very promising programs and projects at how you identify the causes of radicalization, how you identify the people who will be the most vulnerable, how you can intervene in the right way at the right time to head off a tragedy before it happens. We've got a lot of good information to share and a lot of good information that we can borrow from others. And what I found in my discussions in the UK and France, and certainly in Washington this past week with the Five Eyes allies, is that we all want to share our best practices together. The research that's being done everywhere around the world can be utilized by all of us to be the most effective we can be, to stop the radicalization, prevent people from becoming foreign fighters, to build resilient individuals in resilient communities. That's what we need to work very hard to accomplish.
Now, let me ask you about the no-fly list. Does it need to be updated to have more accurate list? And what about a system of redress and appeal for people who get on these lists and can't seem to get off?
Well, all of that needs to be done. The complaints you've seen multiplying in Canada over the course of the last couple of months, particularly involving children and minors. What we have said is this. First of all, under the existing no-fly regulations in Canada, and these regulations have been existing for the last number of years, not just the last few weeks, those regulations do not require a secondary security examination when a red flag comes up about a minor, a child. Obviously, the name on the list is not the six-year-old standing in front of you in a Montreal Canadiens jersey trying to get to the All-Star game in Boston. So the regulations presently do not require the secondary screening. We've pointed that out to the airlines so that they're applying the regulations properly. Secondly, we're undertaking a review of those regulations with our colleagues in the Department of Transport to see if we can put additional identifiers by these names so that the identification can be more precise. Right now, all you get on the screen is a name, and that doesn't carry with it an address, a SIN number, or an individual PIN identifier, or a date of birth, for example. We're looking at all of the ways in which we can make those identification factors more precise so you reduce the number of false positives, which obviously, when that happens at an airport for a six-year-old child, it can be a pretty traumatizing kind of experience for them and for their families. And we will also include the whole issue of no-fly data and information sharing. We'll include that in the overall review of national security that we'll be conducting this year.
And on that, when do you think we'll be able to get a parliamentary oversight committee of our security agencies up and running? I mean, we're way behind the Americans and the
way
British
behind.
Who are doing this.
Well, absolutely. Every one of the Five Eyes countries, not just the UK and the US, but also New Zealand and Australia, they all have some kind of parliamentary or congressional oversight review mechanism. Canada's the anomaly. Interestingly enough, Sheila Fraser, when she was Auditor General, recommended this kind of review or scrutiny technique over 10 years ago. And Anne McClellan, who was one of my predecessors in the previous Liberal government, introduced legislation to create the parliamentary mechanism. The election came along in 2006, the government changed, and Mr. Harper's administration decided not to proceed with that idea, but it is an idea that works in every other jurisdiction virtually in the Western world, and we need to have it in Canada. We're hoping that we can have legislation presented at least in draft form before the summer. We're working hard to achieve that, but Canada needs this kind of mechanism to provide the review and scrutiny of all of our security and intelligence operations. It is not the only mechanism, but is certainly one that is indispensable in the architecture of how we ensure that our system is both being effective in keeping Canadians safe and making sure that our values, rights, and freedoms are safeguarded at the same time.
Mr. Goodall, thank you very much. This was very informative. Appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Bob. Thank you.
Senator, how did it feel your first day of testimony?
Coming up, The suspended senator with a flair for storytelling steps back into the spotlight as lawyers prepare to deliver their final plea for justice.
Are you happy to be on the stand?
Are you the only defense witness?
What to watch for when gabble-to-gabble coverage of the Mike Duffy trial resumes this week. Mike Duffy was a star witness at his fraud and breach of trust trial in December.
Are you finally looking forward to getting to share your story in your own words?
Under oath, Duffy insisted he broke no laws, that good intentions, not criminal intent, lay behind the Senate expense mess that landed him in court. After 61 days of testimony, the legal drama is drawing to a close. When court reconvenes this week, the Crown and defense will deliver carefully crafted final arguments. Then, on a day still to be determined, maybe months away, Justice Charles Valancourt will rule on Mike Duffy's fate. With me in the studio, criminal lawyer Solomon Friedman. Katie Simpson is covering the trial for CTV News. And joining us from Halifax, author and journalist Dan Legere, who wrote the book, Duffy, Stardom to Senate Scandal. So first question to you, Katie. It starts on Monday, as we know. What's the lay of the land? Who's up first? How long is this trial expected to go?
Well, 2 weeks have been set aside for closing arguments, but the judge was very clear in saying, I hope this does not go for 2 weeks. Both sides have to present their written arguments while they present their cases, so that's going to help the judge sort of navigate the waters. The Crown is going to go first, then Don Bain will get his chance to present his closing arguments, and then the Crown will get a chance to reply. And they did it in that way because there were concerns that Don Bain might go on a little too long. So in the most efficient way possible, they've set it up. Crown goes first, then defense. Crown can reply, and they hope it won't take 2 weeks.
So, Dan, when you wrote the book on Duffy, I don't know whether you've had a chance to talk to him, or have you talked to him? And second of all, do you get a sense that there's much interest in the Duffy trial now that the election is over and people have moved on with looking at the Trudeau government?
Well, Duffy isn't communicating with me anymore, Bob, and hasn't really since the book came out. And, you know, I don't blame him, I guess. I also don't blame him for keeping his mouth shut, given the amount of trouble he's in. But I think interest in the trial has definitely ebbed in view of the fact the election's over. We're no longer taking shots at a senator who was named by the sitting prime minister, or are we examining really anymore the fundraising and internal politics of the Conservative Party? All that has been laid bare. So in other words, I think, you know, the damage has been done by this trial. I think the Duffy case was a fairly significant factor in the defeat of Stephen Harper and the Conservatives, but people are moving on.
The Crown is going to be up first. I don't know whether it's going to be Mark Holmes or Jason Neubauer. Both of them are I guess, very experienced Crown prosecutors. But lay out what you think they would be doing tomorrow morning.
Well, what I expect to happen, given the multiplicity of counts here, they'll likely divide up the work. So Mark Holmes will deal with some, Jason Neubauer will deal with others. They may divide it up in terms of law and facts. That happens often. But the most important thing for them to do is to ensure that, although Duffy may have raised some doubt on some of the evidence for some of the counts, that there are still, specifically with regards to the fraudulent counts, enough evidence to get proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that they've conceded, obviously not out loud, but in their minds, they're not going to win everything. But the point is, there are some counts here that surely, when it comes to the expenses at the very least, must result in convictions. I think that's going to be the thrust of their argument. Not to allow just doubt to be thrown up, which would obscure everything, but to really pick out this evidence remained unchallenged. This evidence remained unchallenged. We have the photos, the makeup, etc., the personal training. Those are problems for Duffy. Leave aside, perhaps, the housing expenses and the question of the $90,000 check.
Okay, so Katie, you've watched Don Bain, who is Mr. Duffy's lawyer. He's a credible performer, probably one of the country's preeminent lawyers. What do you think his game plan is?
Well, through this entire case, we've seen Don Bain try to paint Mike Duffy as a victim, and I would expect that to continue as he does present his closing arguments. He has said that he was forced to go along with this by the PMO because it was embarrassing for the Prime Minister's office. And when he dragged all of those emails into court to show just how damaging and how much press the Senate scandal, expense scandal, was getting, he presented the argument that the PMO wanted this scandal to go away. They wanted Mike Duffy to go along with their plan so that it
finally was out of the headlines. But Mike Duffy continued to push back, he says, and didn't want to go along with it. And so I expect that that's what we're going to hear from Don Bain as it goes forward. And Mike Duffy, in his testimony, really presented himself as, I was trying to make the country a better place. Whether the judge believes that or not, again, that's up to the judge.
Solomon is saying that when you come down to that issue of the money, that $65,000 given to Duffy's friend, that was transferred to Duffy's friend, and then some of went to a trainer and whatnot, that is where he might potentially get convicted. And if he is convicted, and if it's a two-year sentence, he's gone from the Senate.
Yeah, any conviction is going to mean the end of his career in the Senate. You know, this is extremely dire. I mean, even if Mike Duffy doesn't go to prison, say, it still could have the effect of really damaging the individual, you know, damaging Mike Duffy so he can't earn a living. And it may do just as much damage, shall we say, as putting a guy in jail. So, you know, there's a lot on the line. There's a lot at stake for Mike Duffy in the next few days. And he's going to be rooting for Don Bain every minute of the day.
So, Solomon, take us through the three principal charges that were laid against them, one involving the $90,000, the housing allowance. You see more trouble for them in terms of the fraud charges.
I do. And, you know, of course, the Crown needs to prove fraud, which is fraudulent intent, and which is a dishonest action and an intent to deceive beyond a reasonable doubt. The trouble here is that there are so many difficulties, both with what appear to be bogus travel expenses, bogus personal expenses. You know, the personal trainer is really the cherry on top. And I don't know that the explanation that was for research into the health and fitness of Canada's seniors is going to wash. Maybe on the other hand, Mike Duffy can point and say that, you know, it wasn't for personal training purposes. This was set up through a contract. It's a difficult argument to accept. But the two other charges, which are the housing expenses, it's difficult to prove because Duffy sort of has the perfect defense. No less an authority than Stephen Harper told me that I was a resident of Prince Edward Island. How did he tell me? He told me I was entitled to sit as a senator. I wouldn't be entitled to sit as a senator if I wasn't a resident. That's what the Constitution says. So that's pretty difficult. That doesn't mean that the expenses weren't improper, they weren't obscene, and Canadians shouldn't be offended by them, but that it shouldn't result in a conviction on the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Then we come to the Nigel Wright matter, and I really think that Don Bain did a good job in terms of muddying the waters on the Nigel Wright check. There's no question Duffy received the check. But what the Crown needs to prove is two important things. Number one, that he was soliciting a benefit. And if we buy the story that this was being foisted upon Duffy, that goes away. We also have to believe that he was intending to offer something in return, right? There's two parts to a bribe, money and a benefit. What was he giving the Conservatives in return? That's very difficult, especially without Nigel Wright being charged. You know, it becomes even more muddy. So I don't think that that's the strong charge. Where we have fraud, however, that is taking something that you're not entitled to. That's how, you know, Mark Holmes put it very simply. This is about stealing paper clips, whether it's $1, $10,000. You can't defraud your employer. And ultimately, I believe that this is where the case is going to rest.
I'm assuming that everybody, including Pamela Wallin, I should say, who is also under investigation for very similar activities, they've got to be watching this case with a great deal of interest, because whatever that judge decides, that's going to have an effect on whether they are charged.
And absolutely. And we saw when the Duffy trial was being scheduled that they actually put Mac Harb's case on hold, because everyone was so interested in how this was going to play out that it was going to, the Crown and the defense both came to that agreement. Will some of these charges stick? Don Bain, as you mentioned, has done he's very skilled at what he does and has sort of muddied the waters in some of those housing expenses, which are similar to some of where the investigations are going with other senators. So it's going to take some time before the judge actually makes his judgment. There's 31 charges. That could take a very long time to sort through.
So, Dan, what's your sense of if Mr. Duffy, for some reason or another, manages to get off on all of these charges, can he recover his reputation?
Yeah, well, two points there. The first one is we all keep forgetting about Raymond Lavigne, the Liberal senator who was charged with things very similar to what Mike Duffy is facing and was convicted and did go to jail. Is that a precedent? We'll see. On the second point, you know, Mike Duffy doesn't have to get elected. He's a senator. You know, there are senators in there who've got pretty bad reputations as it is. I can't see how his reputation would recover. I know he has a group of good, solid, dependable friends who have stuck with him through thick and thin. and they think Mike was unduly singled out for harassment by the authorities. But, you know, in terms of his public image, you know, which was, he was one of Canada's best known journalists, he was a household name, people would flock to him to get their pictures taken with him and get his autograph and things like that. I got to think that part of his life is over, and he's got to carry on as best he can with whatever the future brings.
Thank you very much. Great talking to you. We'll be looking forward to that trial starting tomorrow. Coming up, juggling competing demands from cash-strapped governments as economic jitters grip key industries. Canada's rookie finance minister starts crunching the numbers as an anxious nation awaits the government's first budget.
We began pre-budget consultations yesterday, Mr. Speaker, in committee. And you know why that's important? Because the first time ever the Canadian public are hearing the cost associated with Liberal platform promises for spending. Spoiler alert, it's in the billions.
I will take no advice from the members across the way who left us with an additional $150 billion worth of debt. And what do we have to show for it? The lowest growth since the Great Depression, a couple of gazebos, and a fake lake.
The scrum zeroes in on the trade-offs. Welcome to the scrum with our usual suspects, John Iveson, the National Post columnist, my colleague Gloria Galloway from the Globe and Mail, Donna McCharles from the Toronto Star, and Craig Oliver. So one of the interesting things about watching how the Liberals are trying to govern the country, the way the Conservatives would ignore the premiers and the cities and the provinces, and the Liberals are now engaged in it, and now we're seeing more fights out. Quebec over Energy East, Brad Wall saying, if you're going to give money to Bombardier, you better give money to us. We're sort of back to
UFC,
the way it was, right?
UFC, and it's Fight Club among the premiers
and
the federal government.
Especially at this juncture, right? Because we've got the budget coming up very, very fast, and we have to decide how that money is going to be divided, and everybody is out there asking for their piece of it. You know, this week, the Finance Committee, there are all kinds of folks up there saying, we want you to make good on your promises of the election campaign. Now, how are you going to do that this month? And so, you know, that's a very big part of what's going on.
The government has made too many promises to too many people. They've got promissory notes out there everywhere worth how many billions, we don't know,
but at least 30 billion. We're
going
to find out either Monday or sometime early next week when the finance minister is at the finance committee, and apparently he's going to lay out what the deficit figure is. We're probably a minimum of $25 billion. And as you say, Greg, it could be even higher.
It could be more, yeah.
Imagine if you're one of the parties that had promised to balance this budget, though. Imagine if you're going into this budget and you've made that commitment last fall that we're not going to run a deficit. How difficult would that be? So they're going to have to break a promise somewhere. It's probably going to be the deficit promise.
So, John, I mean, I do think there's a lot of credit in the argument that Bombardier deserves to get some, leaving the politics aside, deserves to get some federal support because it's such an important industry. And yet you see other people like Brad Wall saying, if you're going to give them $1 billion, you better give my sector $1 billion. Now, he is running for, he's going to be in an election, so maybe that accounts for it.
Well, it's you know, the big difference between days gone by and this time around, is, of course, is that the West is hurting as opposed to being the engine of growth. I would take issue with your premise there that Bombardier deserves $1 billion which would essentially make the government of Quebec and the government of Canada the owner of the CC.
Well, they're not, jet. But in my understanding, the way the Bombardier would work it is much different, or the federal would do it, much different than the Quebec government, which is an equity investment.
Equity stake, yeah.
It looks like what the feds are looking at is we'll provide some form of financial credit so you can to send a message to the market that Canada is supporting its only aeronautical industry, but we're not going to give you the money right away. If you need the money, you can come and get it, which I think makes sense.
We have to make a decision whether we want to have an aircraft industry or not. And if we want to have one, I mean, it's so high tech, employs so many people, then we're going to have to do what other countries have to do when they have an aeronautical industry, and that is pay through the nose in terms of government subsidies, payments, loans, they all do it.
That's not a great business case, though, Craig.
No, it's not. I agree.
I think that pay through the nose, you know, I read somewhere that, in fact, the $1 billion they're asking for is actually $1 billion U.S. So
it is
$1.4 billion Canadian dollars. Yeah. And, you know, looking back on, you know, the billions that the company has gotten over the years between federal and provincial taxpayers, you know, the government, the Liberals keep saying they're waiting for the business, they're listening to the business business case, the business case. I think really what's going to make a decisive, have a decisive impact is the political case.
Back to your point, though, Bob, about the tensions in the Federation, which I think are real. You know, it's not just the West versus Quebec, for example. I mean, I think the East is very concerned about this Energy East pipeline. We're starting to hear from parliamentarians that you know, the people are coming back from the oil patch. There are no jobs in the East. What Wall was saying. And others like Andrew Scheer, the former speaker, has been up here talking about the equalization formula needing to be changed to give the, because at the moment it works on a three-year rolling calculation, yes. Which means that it doesn't take into account oil at $30 a barrel. I don't see them making any changes to equalization, but I think, for example, other people in the West have been saying, well, you could do some emergency changes to the employment insurance program, for example, extend it by 5 weeks in the same way that the Harper government did for a period of time in 2008, 2009. So I think they're looking for the federal government to do something to assuage some of the concerns about what's happening in the oil patch if they're going to do something for Bombardier.
And now the government has floated the idea that they may put on a $15 carbon tax, and that has gone not over particularly well with Saskatchewan as well.
Led Zeppelin, the word comes to mind. I mean, this is not...
But again, Wall is campaigning for his own job in very short order, and I think he has to say things like that, but the way it seems that the feds are structuring it is the $15 a number is going to be, you do whatever you want. You know, if you want to tax that back, you know, from people, right. If you want to give it back to people, whatever, that's the price you set. And I think there are ways that even once Brad Wall, you know, gets reelected or otherwise, that they can probably find a way to work with that.
Let's remember, by the way, that $15 tax goes nowhere near meeting the commitments they made in Paris, which is probably $100 more. So they're way out on that regard, and that's why they're going to have such great difficulty meeting
and
the commitments in Paris.
So yeah. Let's talk about General Vance. On Friday, he said that Canada is going to be involved in Libya in some way, but he's not saying, and neither is the defense minister for that. I mean, don't they have an obligation to say, look, does this mean that our surveillance aircraft are going? Are we putting special forces in?
Will it be an air campaign?
Yeah.
Most of all, the general is beating the book of military lexiconography to death to come up with a definition of combat which meets that of his prime minister, to whom he is loyal, who says this is a non-combat mission we're in Iraq. And there we have special forces soldier locked and loaded on the front lines. They've got helicopter gunships ready to provide suppressing fire. They're getting combat pay, but this is not combat.
The general said it should not be called anything other than a support operation.
And he said, I am the expert on what is combat. So he's setting up himself as the final arbiter, and the rest of us, if we say it's combat, we're going to be somehow wrong.
But he is also the one who said this is advise, assist, and equip. And we will mark targets at the front lines
to defend them. And we will engage the enemy.
And we will mark targets offensive operations in support of Iraqi troops. So what does that mean if it's not combat?
What does it mean that we're actually having to put a word on it? If we know what we're doing, if we know exactly what our mission is, going out, marking spaces for bombs to drop, and we know what we're doing. If we call it combat, if we don't call it combat, it's still what it is.
The Prime Minister said it would be non-combat. That was our mission. So
okay, well, let's call it non-combat, but we're still doing the same thing. What does it matter what we call it?
It matters because he made a commitment.
Okay.
Okay, John, let me ask you about the temporary foreign workers program. The government is going to refer to a parliamentary committee to review it, which means obviously they're going to loosen some of the restrictions that Jason Kenney brought in. And Mr. Kenney says, look, this was a pretty well thought out position.
The second time around.
The second time around. And he says it makes no sense, particularly when you have 100,000 people who've lost their jobs in Alberta. Why are we bringing in foreign workers when there's 100,000 people needing work?
Well, I think Jason Kenney's initial move was a solution in looking for a problem. I mean, I don't think the foreign workers thing really was a problem. We had a bunch of high-profile cases that I think Tim Hortons or McDonald's or whatever
banks.
That was a big one. I think that was a legitimate one. And there were some abuses, obviously, but it was only 1% of the workforce. Mm-hmm. You know, if you ask people, they would say it was 20% of the workforce, but it was only 1%. And so he took a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. In the first place, by really tightening up, almost making it unfeasible to bring in temporary foreign workers. So now we're going to see some of this relax. But it's for the worst possible reasons. It's to bring in foreign workers to work in fish plants while literally, I don't know how many thousands, but thousands and thousands of workers down east claim UI.
But, some of the Liberal MPs I was speaking to, saying this on background, of course, is that the guys who are working out in the oil fields and lost their jobs and are coming back home, they don't want to work in a fish plant. No. And the fish plants are saying, we need people to work in these things, so we've got to bring in foreign workers.
Well, what we've also are bringing in, remember, 25,000 refugees, many of whom will want work. And
that's a good point.
So what about those folks?
But they're not temporary foreign workers, they're permanent residents.
The point is, they're people that would be willing to work,
yes.
And that's Mr. Oliver, I think you should be sitting down with the minister and presenting this idea. It's a good one.
The finance committee is sitting next week. You might want to go.
Good.
All right, folks, thanks very much. We appreciate it. We'll be right back.
I am here because I care.
The critical acclaim for Spotlight is unanimous.
Trust me, they control everything.
And now it's been nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture of the Year.
We got to put an end to it.
Spotlight on Blu-ray February 23rd.
I trust Alarm Force. It protects the most valuable thing to me in my whole life, and that's my family.
Get free installation with live two-way voice monitoring and pay only $25 per month.
Alarm Force!
On Elite Singles, I meet smart, ambitious single professionals who are looking for something meaningful. And that's why I chose Elite Singles.
Register today on elitesingles.ca. An Affinitas service. 18 plus free to try.
Wow, look at you.
Ma'am, what happened? What'd you do?
I can't believe it. You look great.
I love the compliments ever since I lost 72.
40.
105 pounds.
But when they ask how?
How?
How'd you do it?
I tell them all I did was walk.
Introducing the 2016 Bowflex Tread Climber. A new look, new features, and still the easiest way to walk and burn up to 2.5 times the calories of a treadmill.
On the Tread Climber, it's so easy. I love that it's at my home. I don't have to worry about anyone watching my kids. I lost 72 pounds in just over a year. I went to a wedding and everyone there was like, oh my gosh, a total transformation.
The Tread Climber combines the movements of a treadmill, stepper, and elliptical into one walking workout, so you burn more calories in as little as 30 minutes 3 times a week. Call or go to walktc.ca for your free information kit. You'll learn how simply walking on the Tread Climber can burn up to 2.5 times the calories of other workouts and without the stress that running puts on your joints.
And the doc's like, hey, you've got high blood pressure, you're borderline diabetic. So my wife surprised me with the Bowflex Tread Climber. It did have the low impact factor, so after workouts, you're not hurting at all. I lost 105 pounds in 18 months. Things are more fun to do now. That's fantastic.
There is no comparison to the Tread Climber. I lost 40 pounds in just 4 months, and I have kept it off for 2 years. The pounds start going away quicker than you'd imagine. 30 minutes 3 times a week is really all it takes. Yeah, it's true.
Walk on your Tread Climber for 6 weeks. If you don't see incredible results, we'll give you your money back. Guarantee.
My husband tells me I'm a hottie. It feels awesome.
I've added years to my life thanks to the Tread Climber.
40 feels pretty good when you feel good about yourself.
Request your information kit today and receive this exclusive offer for free shipping. Plus, learn about special financing for 12 months. Call or go to walktc.ca. That's walktc.ca.
After a really big snowfall, most people reach for a shovel. Others reach for the keys. Jeep Wrangler, 4x4 of the decade.
We're not assassins, Mira. We're spies.
Brody, what have you done?
I killed him. Get me out of here.
Stream Homeland on Crave TV. Start your 1 month trial.
That's our program for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll leave you with the heartwarming story of a political dreamer's wish come true. P.J. Lacampal is a cancer survivor with aspirations to lead the country.
Well, I hope to become politician.
Well, good for you.
This week, he made the rounds in Ottawa in prime ministerial style.
Got my face on a cookie.
Mr. Prime Minister, if we can have you sign the VIP book, which Nelson Mandela has signed.
What?
Okay,
So, hello everyone.
He's Prime Minister PJ in name only now.
Your slogan when you do run, PJ for PM, it'll work great.
But this York University student with a winning attitude has big plans for a future on Parliament Hill. We wish him luck.
I'm living the dream.
Thank you so much,
thank
PJ.
You,
you take good care.
Awesome.